next session, number 30059, Reel 3.
And if we could, there was no pad on the engine that it could be attached to. The engine has a series of pads, as you probably know. This is fastened to the magneto, the generator, and all the things fastened to it. It's had no pad. Then I suddenly thought one afternoon, my God, we've got a vacuum pump on that engine that's just producing vacuum for the instruments. And there's all this pressure going to waste, going blown out the side, by creating a vacuum. Did that put you have? Mm-hmm. Pressure on this side, vacuum on this side. So I just ran a little line from there to the tank and fine, except I found out that you couldn't fill the tanks really full. You only fill them about half full because this was a constant pressure. And at low altitude, there was too much pressure to blow the fuel out of the tank. It pressurized it, yes, but too much so. So I had to have an intermediate device of some kind that as the altitude increased, we put most of the pressure overboard at low altitude. And as the altitude increased, some kind of a thermostat, like a thermostat, it was a pressure relief valve, that would gradually increase the amount of pressure that was delivered to the tank. So it got all the pressure. And I went to British Thermostat Company, who were making a pressure relief valve for something else, for one of the bombers, and talked to them, and they said, sure, I think we're making right now with a few modifications something that will do your job. So I stayed right there all night, and they modified one of these valves for me. And I brought it back and put it on the airplane, and it worked well, just like it had been made for it. Well, I thought I had the problems all licked. And this was all in a matter of about 2 months now, this project. Except that came the jettisoning problem. And they wouldn't all with jettison. Sometimes they got it hung up, and part of one hook would let go and one wouldn't, and the other tank squeegee on there, and it would hurt the performance of the airplane. And I had to find some way to make sure that when the bomb release lever on the airplane was pulled, the shackles were holding the tank on it, that the tank would go. There wasn't anything to hang it up on, because the tubes were the hanging up and everything else. So I finally went to a glass company and had them make me some glass tubes and elbows, proper shape and size and everything. And they just break just like that when the problem is solved. And I think that one of the classic stories of World War II is the corollary of this one. And that is when Wright Field, first of all, through Air Service Command, who were insanely jealous about this thing, because I had gone to the Waterloo, because I was getting tanks, and because I had gone to the thermostat, and I had gone to the glass people, instead of working through them. See, this was early on in the relationship with my outfit with Air Service Command. This was early 43.
You'd still be there if you'd gone through me.
Oh, yes. With a long gray beard, too. But as I say, they were so upset that they sent a secret message back to the States complaining about what we were doing. We were way over our heads. We didn't know what we were doing. We never in the world would be able to make this thing work and so forth and so on. So when we finally got them work, and the normal process then was for Air Service Command to order whatever was required. And so I told General Hunter that he better get on to Air Service Command through Air Force Headquarters and get him to order these tanks from Bowater Lloyd and order the thermostats and all the other things that he wanted, because our project was finished. I brought him out there, brought Flickinger of Republic, and brought even this man Griffiths from Air Service Command out there to see. I demonstrated the tank, I flew it, I showed them the test data on it, and Air Service Command was just livid because we had, quote, scooped them on something, I guess. I don't know. They forgot that, you know, we were all fighting for the same thing. And Wrightfield had ordered Air Service Command to get one of the tanks and send it back to them, which they did. They sent six back, together with all the fittings and everything that we had devised, and the valves and whatnot. 1 year to the day that they got their tanks, and 11,000 tanks had been used successfully by the two B-47 groups in the field. I mean, very successfully. The cable came back from Wright Field saying, in essence, I've got a copy of it someplace, if the idea is no good, it's not workable, would never add to the range of the aircraft, and they'd have to find some other way to do it. 11,000 tanks have been dropped successfully.
A year later.
Well, anyway, I think that's the biggest project. We're going to contribute the most. Oh, there were many, many projects. Had the war gone on another year, I think the next project that we worked on that was so important was the finalization of the Disney bomb for penetration of the submarine pens, the reinforced concrete. Was started by the British Navy and had been put in the hands for communications purposes with various, a man named Terrell, who was a commander in the Wavy Navy and a judge and a stinker. And there's a question here about how we get along with the English. They were wonderful. Everything that happened was wonderful except this one guy. They couldn't make the thing go. They heard about our outfit, and somehow or other, the project wound up in my lap. Here's a concrete piercing rocket propelled bomb idea, codenamed Disney, because Walt Disney had done a film at the start of the war, a very futuristic thing that had rocket-propelled bombs and everything else in it. So they codenamed Disney for this rocket-propelled bomb. First one ever. It wound up in our lap. And I'll never forget being called down to the office of the first Sea Lord. And his staff were there, and Miss Van Terrell. How he ever got the assignment, I have any idea. He knew nothing. Told about the project and told that there had been an arrangement made with the 8th Air Force through General Doolittle that we would take up the project if we wanted to. Would we please? And I was fascinated about the project. I hardly had my hands on it. Perfectly truthful. Although we had projects that list as long. But I said, yes, we'd do it. I'd add a few more people to do some of the work that had to be done. And they brought down to us all the work that they had done. Well, make a long story short, we finished the development of the bomb. We did all the test flying of the bomb. And then we did the first three operational missions with it in January, February of 1945. And against the submarine. And there's a pair of them. Here's a sequence taken from the B-17 that I was flying with. There they go. They're 2,000 pounds each outboard of the B-17, unshackled. And there they go. And here are the submarine pins. This is about 19,450 feet. There's other airplanes dropping them, too. They've been in the same formation. See them go?
Mm-hmm.
Here. And, it's not very interesting, but you can trace the whole thing all the way through, all the way down, until, let's see, I think it really takes a magnifying glass to show the effects. reinforced concrete. And but I expected to see something happen right away, forgetting all this. All of a sudden, I saw the roof of this thing. It's a submarine thing. Just like a cantilever bridge come up like that, and the tail of the submarine come right up through it.
Good.
I've never gotten such a thrill in all my life. Anyway, that was a, as I say, had the war going on, and had the need for destroying these submarines in their pens. By that time, the war was pretty long. You know, by January, February of 45, the war was, the sea war was won, and the land war was virtually won. But that would have been extremely important. That was the very first rocket-propelled bomb that was ever developed.
It must have been very interesting to fly the operational, I mean, instead of depending on someone else to tell you what happened.
Oh, yeah. Well, that was that was one of our secrets. I mean, secrets in Sandpoint. That's why we were able to accomplish what we did, because we could fly and did fly operationally and do our own evaluations instead of depending on somebody else. As you so succinctly there were a lot of other very successful projects. I don't know, I'd have to, I think that, you know, when the B-51s first came to the theater in 44, early 44, I believe it was, the first missions that they flew, they found out they pulled a G on the airplane, the guns wouldn't fire. And, you know, the, in a one-on-one combat, the constant G's pulling around tight like this, and the guns wouldn't fire. You get somebody in the gun sights and squeeze the tip and nothing happens. And we solved that problem for them. And we solved it because it was a must. You know, the B-51 had to be grounded because as far as being of any value as a fighter was concerned, because the guns wouldn't fire under G. And here was a million people in the United States working on, I think, the right field and the North American and every place else developing this airplane, and never found out that the guns wouldn't fire with the G on it.
Was it that it didn't pull enough power? Didn't they change the engine in the one? Didn't they put a more powerful engine in the Merlin?
Oh, I'll tell you all about that. That was the next most important project. The development of the Mustang, which I was partly responsible for. But this, in this case, no, this was, the guns wouldn't fire because the nobody realized that with G's pulled on the airplane that the ammunition belts wouldn't feed. They were hanging up and they wouldn't feed. The minute that you let off the G's, why, they'd come back in place.
Did you just figure that out?
Sure.
I mean, there was no way to look at it while
No way to look at it. Yeah. Just had to figure it out. There had to be a reason for it. If we were not firing, the only reason for the not firing was because the ammunition wasn't seated in the gun. Why isn't it seated there? Well, it's not getting a chance to feed. And it was just about as simple as that. The Merlin, putting the Merlin engine in the Mustang was a project that I helped originate with Rolls through my ex-father-in-law, who was head of the aero engine division at Rolls. Who had a way of winnowing his way into places and getting things done. He helped me in OEM and another project, but in this particular case, we were able to get an Allison-powered Mustang, which was for low-level operation, turned over to Rolls at Hucknall. And they put the engine in. But when it was, I just had a long letter from a man by the name of Ethel. Do you know him? He writes.
Oh yes, Christian Ethel wrote on the Mustang book about the Mustang.
He's writing another one. And I just finished. There's a lot of this goes on all the time. You know, people want information. And
of course.
I think it's great.
I think I have this book on the P-38. I have that one. I don't have the one at Mustang.
Well, he wants to do, he doesn't, he's never written one on the Mustang. He's in the process of writing one.
That's what I read. I think he has a notice in the 8th Air Force News then.
But he may have, I haven't gone through it all that
in that mail call. Because I knew that he was doing one.
But he wants to do it from an entirely different angle that's ever been done before. As he went in to see Ben Kelsey, who is now the Lindbergh professor at the Smithsonian, who ran the outfit along with me when he was there. He only ran it for a little while because he was back in the States most of the time. And I have since talked to him on the telephone, and I sent him a whole bunch of material after a bunch of questions of his. And they're all dealing with getting the Merlin engine and the Mustang. And I say, we did a lot of work after it was done. I went up to Hucknall and flew the airplane. It has so much power, additional power, that after I got it airborne about 200 feet off the ground, and then I decided to see how fast it could climb, and I just shoved everything up to the firewall, expecting to see it just take off like that and snap roll on it. So much power. About 200 feet off the ground. That was a project that we worked, did a lot of work on, but after the British had put the, after Rolls had put the Merlin in the Mustang, and, there were a lot of things that had to be done that were, we recommended changes and so forth, so, and their Packards, who were making the airplanes in the States, their man, Fainter, lived it. Literally lived in my quarters, and he worked there. He went back to Packard and kept going back and forth and carrying stuff back and forth to them. What other? I'll think of some other successful projects too.
We skipped around. I think we skipped. Do you recall in the nature of early work problems?
The nature of early work, well, that's a funny kind of question. What did I write about that? Well, I've been down here first making the P-38 fully operational.
Maybe it was in regards more to the problems, not of planes, but that you had in getting the thing solved. I would think your major work problem was there. Service command.
Well, I think if that's what the question is, I'm not sure I understand the question.
I'm not either.
But if that's what the question is, I would say that the nature of early work problem was in finding facilities that we could get help from, British, basically. Overcoming the resistance of Air Service Command level. Getting people to believe that we knew what we were doing. There was still a school of thought that thought that were convinced that the only people who knew anything about airplanes were Wright Field. Boscombe Down knew nothing about airplanes, and the other British installations knew nothing about airplanes, according to some of our people. They'd have to go right back to Wright Field, and that was, of course, the worst thing that they could possibly do in many instances, tied up in red tape. I don't know how to answer the question, frankly.
We can cover that later and get clarification on it. I think possibly you have in the previous study.
Let's go to 16. I don't. The total strength, I suppose, at one time we had a couple hundred people starting out with four or five people, and working on up to a couple hundred people, and then winding down again as the war, because I had no desire to create an empire, and people were, towards the end of the war, we had think not a day went by that somebody didn't call up and say, can't you transfer me in or out? They wanted people who were finishing their combat tours, and I'd gotten them all and flown with, and come by and say, come on, squeeze that TO and get me in there if you can. And I got some of them that way too, a number of them, good pilots. I got Al Key. Al Key was one of the key people too, not for a play on words, but Al Key and his brother set an endurance record for non-refueled airplanes that still stand. And he did that in 1934, 1935 in Meridian, Mississippi. And Al Key came over there with the 94th Bomb Group, I believe. And then when Doolittle told us that he wanted us to work on bomber problems as well, and I knew not one word about B-17s or B-24s. I went to Kurt LeMay and told him what I needed. I needed somebody real badly, and I said, you ought to give me a good man, because I said, I'd like to have Al Key. He said, no way. I said, well, I'd like to have Al Key. And I'll tell you why. Al is one of these men that grew up with beeswax and baling wire as I did. And I think that he's the type that I need. And he'd flown about 25 missions or so by that time. And he has the operational experience. He has the background in aviation that I need badly. And this will pay off for you and your outfits and your wing if you let him, so he finally let me have it. And that was probably, that was in maybe the spring of 1943, summer of 43, I don't know exactly when he came aboard. But he was the first, I think he was the first, I know he was the first bombardment pilot that we had assigned, and I'm trying to think he was the first pilot after, other than I, but nothing had up to that time. I don't remember, but I can dig it up.
The pilots, when you asked for these pilots, did most of them come willingly?
Very willingly.
Almost eagerly?
Yes. Some perhaps to get off of day-by-day operations, others because they were interested in what we were doing. Dave Schilling, who commanded the 56, was one of my real close friends, said to me one day, he said, I think I'll give up the 56 and come work for you if you'll let me. And I said, I'll tell you, Dave, yes, I'd like to have him. He's a good pilot, but I think you're doing such a good job leaving the 56, I think I have a hard time getting it. He said, let me try. And he went to General Kepler, who was then commanding the fighter commander. And Kepler said, no way. No way. When you talk to him about it. But Dave was an improviser, too, and he spent a lot of time with him. He would fly in and bring me some of his problems, operational problems. Tactics. We did a lot in tactics, too, as well as material, and sit down and devise new tactics that would use the capabilities of an airplane maybe a little bit more than it had been, trying to search out the things that the airplane would do that were peculiar to that particular airplane, and the bad things as well, so to avoid them. Well, they came eagerly, and I said we had a lot of applicants for the job as well.
Did you have feed-in from operational groups in regards to not being able to do certain things in tactics with
planes?
They would tell you, we just can't do this.
Yes, and in some instances it was because they didn't try. You know, when the P-38s were having the dive problems, which I helped on, and P-47 the same thing. Pilots were scared of them and wouldn't utilize the capabilities there. It would stay kind of like a right field approach, to stay well back of the critical.
What were they afraid of in the center of the dive?
Well, the first mission that I flew with B-38s, two pilots rolled over and went down on 109s and kept right on going. Never pulled out of the dive. If only one had done it, I would have thought, well, you know, sudden heart attack or any number of things couldn't happen. But two of them, the same mission. And they've gotten going so fast that the airplane was in a compressible range, and they didn't know what to do to get it out of it. And we worked on that, and I did a high-speed dive. Several of them in the B-38 to try to find out what could be done. And it wound up actually in the Lockheed putting dive flaps on the airplane, but in the meantime all they had to do was to set and find out what the critical airspeed was at any given altitude beyond which it would be uncontrollable. Stay just back of that. And the other thing was to wind just a little bit of tail heavy trim into the trim tab so that the airplane would have a tendency to want to pull itself out of the dive anyway. And that led to the dive flaps that we put on, which actually breaks. The airplane could not get the critical speed, it got close to it. But the dive brakes so not the way that I had designed what should be done in Lockheed. Designed and put on the airplane were directly related to the speed of the airplane, and they would start coming out as the airplane got too fast. It was all automatic. It didn't reach out and turn on, pull on the brakes. It just, as the airplane got going faster and faster, the brakes came out and out like flaps, and they were a little bit of flat, just enough to keep it on. It's compressible.
What about on the Thunderbolt?
Same thing. In the P-38, the controls went absolutely like this. You could sit there and nothing would happen. You could pull on them, you could yank them, you could push them, nothing happened. They just kept going straight down, going faster and faster and faster all the time. And it was a temptation to try to get out, and I couldn't. But then I realized I couldn't get out of the airplane. I really tried. By cranking that little bit of, I turned the engines off, or got off, but I pulled the power way back first of all. Then the nose went under. I'm going like this, I'm going fast. But God, the only way I can get out of the airplane this way if I have to. So put the power back on, straighten the nose up a little bit.